From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Martin Ostermühl and Ben Pavier. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is off this week, and Martin Ostermühl will be joining us later in the broadcast when we will also be talking with D.C.'s Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services, Wayne Turnage. Joining us now is Ben Pavier, State Politics Reporter for Virginia's Home for Public Media, or VPM. Ben Pavier, thank you for joining us.
Kojo, thank you for having me.
And thank you for being our guest analyst today. Also joining us now is Hala Ayala, the Democratic candidate for Virginia Lieutenant Governor. She is also the Chief Deputy Whip in the Virginia House of Delegates, where she represents District 51 in Prince William County. Delegate Ayala, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Thank you, Ben, for having me.
If you have questions or comments for Hala Ayala, you can start calling us now at 800-433-8850. You can send us an email at kojo@wamu.org, a tweet at Politics Hour, or you can reach us on Facebook at The Politics Hour. That number again, 800-433-8850. Remember to call early because you want to get your questions in before we run out of time. Hala Ayala, I know this is not your first time on The Politics Hour. You joined us in January of 2020 to talk about the beginning of the last legislative session before the pandemic, but it's the first time we're having you on as a candidate. For those people who may not be familiar with you, can you give us your 30-second backstory before we get into specific questions?
Absolutely, Kojo. Thank you for having me, and I just appreciate the opportunity. My family struggled growing up. I lost my dad to gun violence at a very young age. We stood in food lines, healthcare was always uncertain. And when I had my son, I was working for minimum wage, didn't know how I was going to provide, and I felt like that I was going to repeat the same vicious cycle, that we would be standing in food lines, and we did. Running for office has been a privilege and an honor of my life to serve, but my lived experiences and bringing the voices of Virginians to the table where the decisions are being made is so impactful. So if I'm elected, Kojo, I'll also be making history as the first woman lieutenant governor and the first woman of color to hold statewide office in Virginia's 400-year history. We're planting seeds to, for the future and ensuring everyone has a seat at the table in the Commonwealth.
So that's the good part. Ben Pavier, is there any scuttlebutt that you can add that the delegate may have left out?
One of the main threads that came up during the nomination fight was this $100,000 donation from Dominion Energy. You previously said you wouldn't take the money from Dominion, so I'm curious to say, hear about what changed your mind on that.
Absolutely. Any politician who can be bought by a donor has no business serving in public office. The title of public servant informs the nature of my job. It's been my privilege and priority to serve in the best interest of Virginians, regardless of the public service corporations or PACs that donate to my campaign. I'm proud of my legislative record, which shows that I'm a champion for clean energy, champion for health care, champion for teachers and families, champion for broadband. And I will continue to fight for clean energies and all of these progresses we have made in the Democratic majority as Lieutenant Governor.
You were first elected to represent District 51 in Prince William County in 2017. You're now the Chief Deputy Whip in the House of Delegates. By the way, what does the Chief Deputy Whip actually do?
Well, it depends on the day, but first and foremost, we look at all the legislation that crosses into our systems and are coming up to be not only routed to committees, but also, to make sure that we are informed about the policy, the specific policy itself, our colleagues and anything that we can help with or questions to answer. Working across the aisle, making sure that, again, that we are up to date on any changes. So if anything should be answered or questions come to the floor, I am a point of contact and a trusted individual that all delegates can come to.
Why
through the legislative process.
Why did you decide to run for lieutenant governor?
Well, I will tell you, you know, running for lieutenant governor wasn't an easy decision because it has been an honor and a joy to serve with my colleagues. When I first came to the House in 2017, you know, these gains that we have made was something that was at the core and passion of my personal lived experiences, but the needs and desires of Virginians and constituents in my district. But I want to be the last woman in the room with the governor and have the opportunity to help and serve even more Virginians and elevate all of these issues that we are going to be talking about today and the gains that we have made to an even higher level. And I can do that as lieutenant governor.
In case you're just joining us, our guest is Hala Ayala, the Democratic candidate for Virginia lieutenant governor. Our guest analyst for this segment is Ben Pavier, state politics reporter for VPM. Ben Pavier.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about the job of lieutenant governor. In Virginia, it seems to me that their most important job is casting tie-breaking votes in the state Senate, which right now Democrats control 21-19. They'll continue to control it by that margin. So it's a very tight margin. So, Delegate, I just wanted to ask you pretty briefly on a few issues you might face, and if you could just give kind of yes or no answers on how you might vote if it's a tie-breaking vote and you have to do it. The first is on right to work, which, you know, critics say is a misnomer, but it bars workplaces where non-union workers have to pay dues. Would you vote to repeal right to work?
Ben, I don't like to speculate on any particular piece of legislation that has yet to come before me. So for me, it is incumbent upon me, not only as a leader, but also working with all of my colleagues to review that piece of legislation and make an informed decision and making sure it goes through the legislative process.
But how do you feel philosophically? Because you've said in the past that you support the repeal of the right to work law. For people who are not familiar with it, that law limits the power of unions, which unions hate because they don't like so-called free riders. What is your philosophical or ideological position on that issue now? Do you still support repealing right to work?
Fundamentally, I believe every Virginian deserves an opportunity to be successful because I've been someone who has struggled. I stand with our workers and small business owners who are working hard to rebuild from our, you know, rebuild our economy in the wake of COVID. I would never support policies at the expense of the rights of Virginia workers and working families. Republicans are trying to convince us to buy this false choice of supporting workers or businesses. Meanwhile, Democrats know we can do both. We can walk and talk and chew gum. Democrats keep our Commonwealth number one for business and has transformed Virginia from dead last to 23rd in the nation for workers.
Ben Pavier.
I also wanted to ask about abortion laws. I mean, this is another issue where you might take a tie-breaking vote. I understand you don't want to speculate, but, you know, would you vote for a bill that loosened Virginia's abortion laws or one that that tightened them?
I support Roe v. Wade. I am a pro-choice candidate and champion. I will always protect an individual's right to choose.
Well, this week, the new Texas law banning most abortions after 6 weeks was temporarily blocked by a federal judge, but not before it made waves in the Virginia statewide races. Your Republican opponent, Winsom Sears, said she would support a similar law in Virginia. Do you see that as a possibility in Virginia's future?
Well, Kojo, my opponent and I have very different visions of what direction Virginia should go in. I want to take Virginia forwards, and Winsom only wants to take us backwards. She doesn't support abortion in cases of rape or incest. You know, she also has stated that she thinks a pharmacist should be able to deny someone contraceptives based on their personal beliefs. I'm a firm believer in reproductive rights and justice, just like the majority of Virginians, including Republicans. If my opponent truly believes that an unconstitutional, dangerous bill like the one that is passed in Texas would be popular in Virginia, she should think again.
Your turn, Ben Pavier.
Sure. I wanted to ask you about another piece of news that came out around your opponent, Winsom Sears, a former Republican delegate. She declined to tell CNN whether she's been vaccinated. She compared it to disclosing if you're HIV positive. She said in a tweet later that I encourage everyone to get the vaccine, but no one should be forced to disclose their vaccination status. I wanted to hear your reaction to that and whether you share any of those views.
Well, thank you for the question, Ben. Real leadership is leading by example, which is what our Democratic majority has done from the very start. And That means expanding access to healthcare and supporting our schools, workers, and businesses through this pandemic. Real leadership, as I've stated earlier in my my press release, not hiding from your constituents at a time, you know, when they really need to hear from you the most, and refusing to disclose if you've gotten that, especially if you refuse to disclose if you're vaccinated. As a public health and safety issue for me, I think it's incumbent upon us as public health, in the best interest of public health, and as an elected official, if we're running for the second highest office in the Commonwealth, we need to be able to lead by example. And if she is vaccinated, I question why she wouldn't want to say so. And if she isn't, I hope she does get vaccinated.
Under vaccine mandates, that's something that Democratic candidate for Governor Terry McAuliffe supports, but Republican candidate Glenn Youngkin opposes, as does Winsome Sears. Sears, do you support vaccine mandates in general?
Kojo, thank you for the question. I believe the science should be our guidance, which shows clearly that getting the vaccine is the best ways to keep kids, families, our communities, all of us safe. Yes, I am vaccinated, and I'm happy to share my story about why I made that choice. And if you have the time, you know, I'll be happy to. But I want to make sure that every Virginian feels comfortable about getting the COVID-19 vaccine. We need to do our part to make sure we encourage everyone to be safe so we can return to some sense of normalcy.
What about specifically for schools and child care providers?
You know, it is very important, again, Kojo, that we follow the science. I couldn't imagine. I've been a PTO president. I have been in communities. I'm around families all the time. It is incumbent upon us to do our part. The teachers should get vaccinated, and I won't sacrifice children's lives for politics. We need to do our part to protect everyone.
So you're saying that both teachers and students should be vaccinated?
Teachers, and let's be clear, let's follow the guidance and the science that has been given and advice that has been given to us by authoritative sources. And my son has gotten the vaccination. My daughter has gotten the vaccination. My nieces and nephews, who are way younger than all of us, have gotten the vaccination. We need to do our part. I don't know about you, Kojo, but again, as an individual that's crisscrossing this Commonwealth, who is in contact with lots of individuals, as well as of people bringing their kids and their family members to connect with us as we are talking to voters, I couldn't imagine hurting someone, unintentionally so, and well, knowing that I could get a free vaccination, you know, and do my part.
You may not know about me, but I know about me. I'm fully vaccinated, waiting for my booster, and encourage everyone else to do the same. But we got a tweet from Greg that says the candidate did not answer the question about why she changed her position and accepted the $100,000 donation from Dominion Energy. Please re-ask. So now I'm re-asking.
Look, we have connected with voters, and what I'm hearing from voters is that they are concerned about our clean air and clean water and making sure we did our part for renewable energies. And again, I will never, no donor, no PAC influences the way I vote.
But why did you change your mind?
Voters. The money went towards talking to voters and sharing our message of progress. And unfortunately, in campaigning, that is a resource that is needed to do that. And that's what I used it for.
Ben Pavier.
Yeah, just a follow-up on Dominion Energy. I mean, for listeners who may be outside of Virginia, this has historically been a very powerful political interest in Richmond. Do you support any, you know, more regulations around the company? A lot of those were loosened over the last decade, two decades. Do you think there should be more scrutiny, oversight over the company?
You know, I will have conversations with our stakeholders. I will have conversations with our voters. Certainly not saying no, but I'm not saying yes. Again, we don't speculate on legislation or regulation that may become before a committee or go through the process. I want to make it clear that I will read everything that crosses my desk, and I want to give every bill and every regulation, if that's what the bill is, a fair shot.
Here now is Joe in Fairfax, Virginia. Joe, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Delegal Ayala. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, Joe. How are you?
Very good, very good. I have two questions. There was a law passed last year to erase the convictions of either misdemeanor or felonies for people who have been free of any type of crime. My question is, I just heard that it's going to take about 3 to 4 years to implement a law. Why is that? And if you become lieutenant governor, is there any way you can accelerate that process? That's my first question. Second question, police reform in the state of Virginia. Mm-hmm. What do you think about reforming the police? Thank you very much for all you do, by the way.
Thank you so much for that question. You know, this is a personal issue for me, and I'm personally scared that every time my children leave their houses and when they're in the house or at work, that something could happen to my black children. In the General Assembly, I was proud to be part of groundbreaking pieces of legislation that made the most progress on criminal justice legislation in the country with my Democratic colleagues, including legalizing marijuana, creating automatic expungement, abolishing the death penalty, and banning no-knock warrants. But we do need to decriminalize also mental health. It is a crisis, and provide additional funding for these crisis intervention centers. When we talk about reforms that we've done, this is the floor, not the ceiling, and we need to definitely, to your point, Joe, continue to build on these conversations. We've only been in the majority for 2 years. The progress we have made to remove Jim Crow laws, to remove Byrd laws, and to put equity in our criminal justice system is something we are all striving for. One more cup of coffee, Kojo, today is needed.
Well, at a September debate, Democratic candidate for Governor Terry McAuliffe walked back his support for ending qualified immunity, which is a legal protection for police officers for most civil lawsuits. Do you think Virginia should end qualified immunity for police officers?
Thank you for that question. My role as Lieutenant Governor will be able to cast tie-breaking votes in the Senate as a general rule. I don't like to speculate on legislation before I see it because I want to give, again, every bill a fair shot. Here's what I'll say, though. In order to keep our community safe, we have to rebuild the trust that has been broken between our communities and law enforcement. And that starts with increasing accountability. When someone violates the law or acts unethically, we should absolutely consider reforms to qualified immunity, not only to make sure that bad actors don't just get to walk away without consequences, but also send a clear message to rogue officers that they cannot, in fact, do whatever they want to do without facing consequences.
Ben Pavia.
I don't have this in front of me, but I'm curious how you voted on the qualified immunity bill that came up last year.
I did support it in the House, but unfortunately it did not pass in the Senate.
Gotcha. Okay. And a question about marijuana, which is, as you pointed out, just recently legalized here, but you know, you can't go to a store and buy it. It's you can grow plants. Do you support speeding up the timeline to allow more retail stores? Right now, the timeline, I think, is set for 2024, mm-hmm. So a few years out.
You know, Ben, when we had this conversation about marijuana, this is one of many criminal justice reforms that were very important to do while this past session and while I was in the House, too. It was on the forefront of our minds. This is something that has been disproportionately impacting our black and brown communities. But if reforms come up, again, I don't want to speculate on any piece of legislation. Know that I am only the tie-breaking vote as lieutenant governor. And Justin Fairfax actually broke the tie to deliver marijuana justice here in the Commonwealth. And it was the governor that decided to move that timeline up to July 2021. Instead, ahead of 2024. So with all of these moving parts, if more reforms come to the body and I'm the tie-breaking vote, we'll see what happens. You know, I'll read the bill and make an informed decision then.
And Delegate, what are you telling voters? You know, there's a sense I've heard from some people in your party that there's a little bit of voter apathy this year. People are tired of the mudslinging and the politics of the last, you know, 5 years plus years. How are you framing the stakes for this race for voters in Virginia in this off-year election?
Great question, Ben, because what I'm hearing from voters is how excited that they are about the future of the Commonwealth. They're also wanting to make sure voters get out to vote, and we see people door knocking, phone banking happening. We're crisscrossing the state, the whole ticket. Today I'm in Hampton Roads, and yesterday I was in Richmond and Charlottesville. Look, voters are excited about continuing the progress we have built. When Donald Trump was in office, we have seen some things that I've never thought I would see before. This is why this election is so important, to protect the measures and gains that Virginia has made and the General Assembly. These are just beginning conversations about criminal justice, about housing, about schools, about health care. Just so much is at stake.
But a new survey from the Wasson Center at Christopher Newport University shows that you have a 4-point lead over your Republican opponent. A prior Wasson Center survey from August showed you leading by 10 points. Are you concerned about the fact that lead has shrunk so apparently significantly?
Thank you for that question, Kojo. What I will say is I respect all polling. My focus is on getting out the vote, talking to every voter as I'm crisscrossing the state, and making sure Democrats win November 2nd. So as your listeners are listening, a shameless plug, if you haven't done so, sign, seal, deliver that absentee ballot or request it. And if you don't remember, but please remember, go to iwillvote.com and check out when Election Day is November 2nd.
You have respect for polling, but do you believe the actual polling? Do you believe, in fact, that your opponent is drawing closer to you, and if so, why?
Oh, Kojo, you're so tricky. But my focus is on November 2nd. Eyes on the prize.
Okay, here is Kim. Oh, I'm sorry. Kim is for our next guest. I should be going to Rob in Arlington. Rob, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hey, Kojo. Thank you for taking my call. Delegates, congratulations on. I've already voted for you, by the way, and I'm very hoping that you will be our next lieutenant governor. But my quick question is, very staunch pro-gun safety advocate, do you foresee any more possible work in that area? I just heard about a giant gun show is going to happen. I thought those were done with. Is there a possibility of further gun safety legislation, maybe eliminating these ridiculous gun shows and the potential for more gun violence? Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. You know, this is something that's very personal to me. Losing my father to gun violence was tragic for my mother. I was so young, I didn't even remember, but she told me this story about how I lost my father and how she found out about my father's passing. You know, I worked very hard in the General Assembly, and we worked for gun safety reforms as we're seeing this crisis play out across our nation. I'll talk from the heart if you'll let me, but I will say that as a mother, as a parent, as someone watching this happen and who has experienced it firsthand, I never want another Virginian to ever face it. The current lieutenant governor delivered red flag laws and reporting of a lost and stolen firearm in which I chief co-patroned with Delegate Bourne. We need to ban ghost guns. This is a public health crisis. So whatever we can do to move Virginia forward, I will review that legislation, make a decision there. But this is a very personal experience and story and important to me.
I'm afraid we only have a minute left. Ben Pavier, you get the last question.
The last one I have is a little bit wonky, but there's some movement among Democrats in the legislature to make changes to Virginia's income tax, which is more or less flat right now. It's around 5.75% for anyone making more than $17,000 a year, so most people. You know, do you think there should be a change to that system where the rates are kind of tied to income?
And if you can answer that in 30 seconds or less, more power to you. Go ahead.
You know, we need to continue to deliver minimum wage raises. We need to read every piece of legislation that comes across our desk regarding taxes, regarding any changes to the future tax structures. I remember working a minimum wage job myself, so I guess I'm out of time.
Just about, Hala Yala. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kojo, for having me. Thank you, Ben. And thank you to our listeners.
Ben Pavia, thank you, too. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Wayne Turner, D.C.'s Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. I mentioned earlier that Tom Sherwood is off this week, so joining us in his place as our guest analyst is Martin Ostermuhl. You know who he is. I don't have to describe him. He's on these airwaves all the time. He's an editor and reporter for WMU and DCS. Martin, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And Martin joins us because our guest in this segment is Wayne Turnage, DC's Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services, who joins us now. Wayne Turnage, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
If you have questions or comments for Wayne Turnage, now is the time to call 800-433-8850. Send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or a tweet at Politics Hour. Before we get to D.C. specifically, Martin Ostermuhl, Roy McGrath, he is Maryland Governor Larry Hogan's former chief of staff, who was indeed found to be controversial when his payout package from his previous government job was revealed in the Baltimore Sun. Now he's in the news again. He's facing federal and state criminal charges, including one for apparently recording the governor's phone calls without his permission.
Yeah, I mean, in the grand scheme of regional political scandals, which we've covered many of them, this is like a special brand. It's got like a little Old Bay spice kind of tossed on top of it. It makes it extremely exciting. Yeah, Roy McGrath, I mean, allegations now that he, on his way to get this $233,000 settlement when he was leaving the Maryland Environmental Service, basically he essentially told the board of that group that Governor Hogan had greenlighted this allegedly, which seems like an issue, and then also allegedly had recorded these phone calls with Governor Hogan, which any reporter will tell you that in Maryland you need the consent of two parties to record a phone call. Now, that's a relatively minor issue, but still the fact that this is kind of involved in this broader scandal, I suppose, involving public funds and embezzlement is kind of interesting.
Governor Hogan was like, I told you what? and then, of course, Tom Sherwood is not here, but he loves to say this is the politics hour. So let's talk politics for a second in terms of who's going to be running for mayor of D.C. Tom Sherwood broke on Twitter this week that at-large council member Robert White is almost there.
And all I can say is that Tom Sherwood did break the news. I've confirmed it. There is someone out there is confirming to me that Robert White, council member since 2016, is looking really hard at the race for mayor in the district. What's really interesting about this, I don't think it's much of a secret. I mean, there's always been kind of thoughts that he could be a mayoral contender. It's just the fact that we're now in October and no one has jumped in the race of
including our incumbent.
Including the incumbent. Mayor Bowser has not announced her intentions yet. And in usual election cycles, you usually have people announcing over the summer. I mean, they take a year to run because they have to get name recognition, they have to raise money. So this is interesting how there's still some kind of like, you know, slow, hesitant steps towards people saying, well, maybe I'll consider running, but I'll believe it when someone actually launches a campaign.
In case you're just joining us, our guest is Wayne Turnage, D.C.'s Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services, who, as far as we know, is not planning to run for mayor. Wayne Turnage, your department recently launched a pilot program to house residents from three encampments before permanently clearing the camps. Can you tell us the scope of that project and how it was developed?
Sure, I'm happy to. The scope of the project includes four, potentially five sites. One at the M Street underpass, another at the L Street underpass. We have an engagement coming at New Jersey in O Street Park. And we are planning to look at the encampment at 21st and E Street and the one along Virginia Avenue. It came out of a recognition that we were in a stubborn pandemic, the fourth wave at the time that we were looking at this issue, that there was a recognition optically that the number of tented encampments were growing across the city. And the persons who were living in those encampments were at extreme risk, not only from potentially contracting COVID, but also from the elements associated with living outside, including having people prey on persons who are living unsheltered. And so we decided to sort of take a modification of the Housing First model to see what would happen if we deployed that strategy in Washington, D.C., and focused on those encampments that I identified and decided to, approach the residents of those encampments who were on a list that we generated over the course of the summer and asked them, would they be willing to accept housing? In the process, we identified over 100 residents, probably around 111 now, and we concluded that if we could give them housing, which would be the first test, how fast would we be able to lease them up compared to the normal housing process? Once we leased them up, once we made this offer, how many would accept it? How many would reject it? For those who rejected it, what would be the reasons? Once we executed the housing first model, we then indicated our plans to shut down the encampments behind housing those residents. Again, testing the notion of whether or not you can safely and humanely close some areas of the city to future encampments for reasons that vary in number. And so we undertook to start this in September, and it sort of bled over into October, and here we are.
Well, the safely and humanely part has now become a part of a controversy. Here's Martin Ostermuhl.
Yeah, so I mean, earlier, the first encampment clearing as part of this pilot program happened. It started this Monday. I was down there reporting on it. Now, it got suspended halfway through because there was an incident where a city worker driving what was effectively a small bulldozer lifted up a tent, and there was actually still a person in there. Now, thankfully, they weren't injured, but, I mean, obviously provoked a lot of concern. We've got council members, including Robert White, Alyssa Silverman, Brianna Doe, I think Janice Lewis-George, a couple others are now expressing concerns. They're either saying this has to be changed or paused. So I guess just jumping straight into it, I mean, after what happened in Noma on Monday, are you considering making changes to how these encampments are eventually closed, or are you thinking of putting off any future closings because of the concerns that this could happen again, these sorts of incidents?
Well, to repeat, we paused it for a day. We wanted to make sure that there were no injuries. We ensured that by asking the affected resident to go to the hospital. We ensured that he arrived at the hospital. He had a brother at the site. We determined, based on the reports we received, and the fact that the gentleman came back to the encampment area that night, there was no injury. Both he and his brother were placed in a hotel, and they have apartments being established for them. So we paused to make sure those things were taken care of. We have no plans to pause the encampment pallet for the rest of the program. Our goal is to test those policies that I outlined. We think those policies are critical to understanding how to effectuate positive change for persons who are living on the street through informed data and not speculation. And that is what the pallet will provide for us.
Let's be clear. Are you saying the pause has now ended?
Yes, the pause was to ensure that everything was fine at the site after the resident was unfortunately lifted with his tent. We want to make sure that the resident was not hurt, and we want to make sure that resident had access to a hotel until we could arrange his housing. Those things have been done, and so now we move forward. There are still residents at Noma who were on our original list for persons who are in line for immediate housing, and we will go back to Noma on next week, and we will reconnect with those individuals and execute the housing first offer for them as well.
So
in the meantime, we then move next to New Jersey and O Street Park.
All right. Well, one thing, you mentioned the housing first model, and I've been down to Noma a couple times over the last few weeks. I've met people who have been housed up, and were very happy to have an option to go into their own apartments. But then I also met people who said either they, A, weren't approached, or B, they had a voucher in hand, but were still trying to jump through the last hoops, like their unit had to get inspected or something like that. And now there's activists, advocates, and council members also saying, why do the clearing part when there's still these people that are in the process? Like, you have someone who has a voucher and has to wait 4 days until they get into their apartment. Why are you sending a crew down to necessarily say to them, you got to go? Would you consider?
Well, I think that's a misrepresentation of what we're doing, to, in all fairness.
Okay.
That is an egregious misrepresentation. If a person is offered housing and that housing is not readily available, we will put them in a hotel until the housing is available. Now, some people have indicated to us that they don't want to go to a hotel. In those cases, we allow those residents to stay where they are. So to give you the specific numbers so that everybody is clear, we started this encampment in L in for the L and M Street underpass with 45 residents who we identified over the summer on our by name list. 11 of those residents either decided not to engage with us, or they decided they didn't want housing. That reduced the pilot group to 34. Of the remaining 34 pilot group members, 20 members have leased up to date. 7 group members still reside at NoMa because they decided to stay there until they could be leased up, and we expect that to happen in less than 2 weeks. And 7 additional members agreed to go to a hotel while the matching process with their apartment continued. So I think if you did the math, that's about if you base it on the original 45 members, that's about a 75% success rate. And we certainly have, you know, individuals certainly have a right to walk away from our offer. We can't mandate anybody do anything, and we respect that. But to suggest that we are somehow telling people who've agreed to go to housing and that housing is not yet available, that they have to move from that spot or be displaced, is not true. We give them the opportunity to stay there until the housing process is complete. Now, we would prefer they leave, and we offer them a hotel so they would possibly leave. But we're not making them leave if they decide to stay at that site.
Let's talk numbers, because this is the time during which the Street Sense newspaper has its D.C. Homeless Crisis Reporting Project annual news blitz. You can find more about that at dcs.com. But according to one report, the number of chronically homeless people this year has increased, even though the overall number of people experiencing homelessness has gone down. What have been the successes so far that led to the overall number of unhoused people decreasing? And what are the biggest challenges you now have in getting people who are chronically unhoused off the streets? One Twitter user asked, could you please ask if the district government has considered having some legal encampment areas in the city? And if not, why not?
Well, so your first question, we believe that the overall homeless number hasn't decreased because of the incredible success that Mayor Bowser was able to accomplish.
That was a gift I gave you, wasn't it?
Yes, there was a gift, and I'm going to take it with the our family housing program. What the mayor said when she ran for mayor that she was going to close D.C. General, and she did. And then she worked with our very capable leader at DHS, Laura Zeilinger, and they put together an amazing transitional housing program, short-term housing for families, so they would not have to live on the street or in a place like D.C. General. And the goal is to get them in, stabilized, and get them connected to housing, I think within 60 to 90 days. That program has created a remarkable decline in the number of families who are considered living homeless. As for single homelessness, that is a bigger challenge. I think the numbers are correct that a substantially larger proportion than was initially estimated 4 or 5 years ago are living are chronically homeless. And the myriad of problems that attend to being chronically homeless are the challenges that we have to deal with. And that is why we are, and that is why the housing first model is so important. The whole model is premised on the notion that the most important thing that you can do for a person who's living on the street is put them in a shelter, an apartment, a home. And then you can deal with the other issues that, while are important, are not as critical to their homelessness as not having a roof over their head.
Martin?
And that's what this homeless first model is designed to do. and why people would call into question its value, given that the goal is to put people into housing, is a mystery to me. But, you know, we will, we're certainly open to answering any questions that people have about
our
efforts.
That's why we're here, to solve those mysteries. Here's Martin Austin.
So one criticism I'm sure you've heard, because you've probably heard plenty, is that there's questions around why these sites were chosen. I mean, the one in Truxton Circle at New Jersey and O, that's a park that's going to be redeveloped, so there's probably some logic there. But there's the one at E and 20th, which is in Foggy Bottom, close to kind of the Federal Reserve. There's the ones in NoMa. And some people were saying that this was an issue of political optics, that someone up on high was like, listen, I don't like having encampments in these parts of town, so let's do something with these sites. I mean, was there a specific logic for you guys to pick these three particular kind of areas for the pilot program?
Yes, this was a bottom-up process. We worked with our staff on the ground. We have an amazing encampment team. It's just absolutely amazing. And I challenge anybody to look at the dedication of this staff and call into question the work that they do. They are incredible. We worked with Jessica Smith, with Jamal Walden, with the staff that work for Jamal. And we asked, you know, what are the largest and most difficult and most challenging encampment sites that we should identify as a part of the pilot? And it was a bottom-up process, and we came up with these four sites. The fourth site on 21st and E will have an extension to Virginia Avenue. So it was based on the on-the-ground perception that these are some of the most challenging encampments based on size, based on health and safety hazards in some cases, and based on the impracticality of having these sites exist as tenant encampments against all the other issues that I identified.
Last month, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser extended the city's contract with MedStar so that the company could continue providing Medicaid services to low-income district residents. She did this by declaring a state of emergency. The contract with MedStar was set to expire after a judge found that the contract violated city procurement rules. What's going on here?
Well, what's going on is that the problem has been solved. The mayor, back in February of this year, basically stated publicly that while the outcome of this procurement it was yet to be determined, her goal was to make sure that we just did not disrupt the health care of any residents during this pandemic. And so she asked for some specific accommodations based on first a bill, then a Budget Support Act language, and then the use of her emergency authority to declare the three contracts that defined the managed care program, to declare them as an emergency indicating that they should go forward for at least 9 months while we do another procurement. There was obviously a tremendous back and forth with the council, but I am pleased to say that Chairman Mendelson worked with the mayor and her team to negotiate a path forward that essentially guarantees what the mayor asked for, and that is no disruption to the healthcare of those 250,000 residents who rely on Medicaid managed care. And so that is solved. The council member was able to deliver the support of 11 members. One member abstained or voted present, and another member voted no. But fortunately, we live in a democracy where the majority rules, and the 11 members vote carried. And we
so
now
that
have
problem has been solved.
That problem it has been solved.
For the time being, anyway. Here's Martin Austin.
For the time being. Yes.
But has the city, did D.C. get pushed around by MedStar? I mean, that was the accusation in the council from some council members who were very upset with this whole process, are also concerned about the council's role in oversight of contracts. But largely they said MedStar was basically the, you know, whatever 1,000-pound elephant in the room that could kind of got its way because it's just that big.
It was their accusations are without merit. MedStar is unquestionably a major, major player in the delivery of health care to the poorest and sickest residents in the city. They have been for years. What people don't realize is MedStar has paid less than their costs to deliver care to Medicaid manage to persons on Medicaid. Now, if they were this 2,000-pound gorilla, you would expect that they would be the highest paid health system in the city with respect to Medicaid. They are not. They don't get the highest rate. And their contracts with the health plans were ending, one in September of last year, or September of the last fiscal year, and one in November of this fiscal year. They have every right as a vendor, private vendor, to when their contracts end, to say we want to renegotiate terms for the next contract. That is not underhanded. That is not duplicitous. That is the normal way that people conduct business who have contracts. And so I think if you look at the history of MedStar in serving persons who are on Medicaid, either through our managed care or fee-for-service program, you won't see a company that treats that responsibility lightly.
Well, the council had a lot to say, and over the summer, you wrote a Washington Post opinion piece called, quoting here, "It's time to revisit the D.C. Council's role in contract review." What would you like to see changed?
Well, you know...
Yeah, get yourself in trouble. Go ahead.
This is a dangerous... This is thin ice right here, so go ahead and walk on it.
As an executive, as someone who works in the executive branch, this is my personal view. I don't ascribe them to the mayor or anybody else. I think it is the executive's job to pick the winners in procurement. And I think it is the council's job to approve those contracts by calling balls and strikes as to whether or not those procurements were effectively conducted. I don't think it's the council's job to call into question a decision by the executive through the procurement process to select winners that they may not like. But, you know, the law is as it is, and that process will certainly survive my tenure in D.C., but I just think that you allow for a more orderly process.
Only a little more than 2 minutes left, Martin.
All right. Well, you certainly wouldn't be the first person to call for changes to how the council does contracts. Even some progressive members have said in the past that opens up kind of allegations of you know, not necessarily corruption, but kind of people throwing their weight around, interference, that sort of stuff. I just want to quickly turn back to, because I know there's been a lot of questions about this. In terms of the encampment clearings, you said the next one is at New Jersey and O. It should happen sometime in November. Can you just spell out what's that one going to look like in terms of how it happens compared to what NOMA was like? I mean, is there going to be more secure, more police there? Is it going to be more of a kind of perimeter to keep people out? Like, how are you guys going to conduct that one?
No, I don't. We don't envision having a major police force at any of the encampments. We certainly need some minimal show of support from MPD to make sure that, you know, there's no unruly behavior that goes on and disturbs the process of trying to help house our residents. But we will set up a normal perimeter around the park. It'll be a physical perimeter that will be either tape or possibly fencing, because that park is going to be closed when we leave, not because of not just because of the encampment, but the whole park is going to be renovated. We will then, the role of MPD will be to secure those entry and exit points. And then our outreach teams will work with the encampment residents inside of the perimeter to connect those who are on the by name list to housing, and then remove with their permission any of their belongings that they will not be taken to either a hotel for a temporary stay or their apartment. And so that is essentially the process in a nutshell.
And I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. But Cortland Malloy profiled you about your role as deputy mayor, and you talk candidly about having diabetes and high blood pressure in 30 seconds or less. How are you handling that now?
I just had a physical. My diabetes, my A1C score dropped again for the second time in a year. Still not great. I'm about a 7.2. That's for those who follow our A1C scores. The normal is, I think, 5.7. Yep. I will never see normal again. But 7.2, I'm going in the right direction.
Wayne,
my high blood pressure is completely under control.
Wayne Turnage, thank you so much for joining us. Martin Ostermuhl, thank you for joining us. Tom Sherwood will be back next week. Stay safe. Have a great weekend. I'm Kojo Nambi.
Politics Hour with Kojo Namdi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Inga-Lisa Schrobsdorf. Our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Today's engineer was Natalie Yurovlivker. Mana Kashvi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows and more content, visit thepoliticshour.org.